I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free. I wish I.
The wonderful Nina Simone with I Wish I Knew How It Feels to Be Free, a song written that became one of the anthems of the 1960s civil rights movement and, in 2004, the theme for the Olympics. This song was written by Dr. Billy Taylor and Richard Carroll Lamb, and was released as a single in 1967 and then appeared later that year on her album, Silk and Soul. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we are continuing our Free Your Mind Week, leaving open the forum for exchanging ideas about where we are politically and what should the strategy be at this time. The Republicans are toward the tail end of their national convention in Cleveland. The Democrats will begin theirs afterwards in the city of brotherly love. At that convention, they will, of course, nominate officially Hillary Clinton as the standard bearer for the party's general election in November. The Republicans have already done so, officially naming Trump. So here we are with a lot of excitement, millions and millions of dollars being poured now into feverish advertising campaigns. We look at how the media just have been covering this election so far. But we also see some very troubling signs, one being that the American public, the voting public, is decidedly disenchanted with both candidates who will be representing the duopoly. At the same time, we had a burgeoning movement within the Democratic Party under the aegis of Bernie Sanders, which appears to have stalled. Bernie Sanders, of course, is expected to make a major speech on the first day of the Democratic convention. We don't know what he's likely to say then. We know that he's going to tell his folks, he's going to have a meeting prior to his statement with whatever is left of the so-called movement. And he's going to be telling his delegates something. I don't know what it is that he'll be telling them. But one surmises that he'll be telling them that he has not given up at all on the high ideals of this revolution, that he will insist on certain planks being incorporated into the Democratic Party platform, that to that degree, the revolution was successful in that it changed the ideological orientation of the party. Well, we can have a discussion as to whether that was the purpose of this revolution to begin with. The purpose of the revolution, it seems to me, was not about changing the culture of the Democratic Party, but carving another way in fact, a way out of it, with championing of a number of issues that the party astutely avoided addressing, let alone accomplished in terms of legislation. So we have that to watch. But we also saw some pretty interesting things happen with the Republicans. And more, building on this theme of clarity that I talked about before, that it is vital not to fall for any of all of this. This is all choreographed. This is propaganda at its highest level, and it's orchestrated, it's organized, and a lot of money is going into this. Now, people think when you tune in and you see, you know, this news organization has it set and they're doing on-site commentary and all this kind of stuff. All of this is arranged. All of this is part of the circus, and all of this is meant to provide innocuous coverage. They're really not there to disturb anything. So they're not going to tell you what you really need to know. They're not going to deal with any controversies whatsoever. They're not going to delve too deeply into anything. They're there simply to fulfill their obligation to their respective advertising departments. And the advertising departments are looking for serious money at this time when the election is going to go into high gear, all the more because Hillary Clinton is not doing that well in the polls. Donald Trump, too, is not doing all that well, but comparatively speaking, he has performed spectacularly. Here's a guy who had never been in political life, but who had some money and a great idea that entitles him to rule the world. And he decided that, well, like anything else, the party is an acquisition. Why not just go and acquire it? And he did. He acquired the Republican Party. He's benefiting from its largesse and its whatever goodies go along with that. A party been in existence for so long, the respectability, the recognizability, and certainly the national organization with which he could climb very quickly and catapult himself into political orbit that he couldn't do even with his money. So he did a spectacular job. What is upsetting Republicans right now is that he's so crude. He's so bereft of intellect. You know, Donald Trump reminds me of an experience I had as a child. In our household, we had the oilcloth tablecloth for the kitchen. That's for us, the runts of the family. Every day we eat in the kitchen, and the oilcloth was a tablecloth. And if some friends and relatives were to come by, then we would graduate. My mother would drag out the better tablecloths. But on this one occasion, somebody was coming to the house, and my mother did the thing that she rarely did, which was she went for the Irish linen tablecloths. That's big, because they weren't even kept with the rest of the linens. You know, the Irish linen tablecloths and napkins. So this was a big deal. These were big deal people coming to the house. And so she dressed up her table with her Irish linen tablecloths. And, you know, we did what we were supposed to do as children. You made yourself as scarce as possible, and you leave the adults to do their thing. But we were in the kitchen when my mother came storming in and was in a rage. And we couldn't figure out why was she so angry. What was she so angry about? What did we do? Turned out that whoever these hoi polloi people were visiting that she catered to and cooked for and got out the Irish linen tablecloth for, the man of this group wiped his fingers in my mother's Irish linen tablecloth, and she was beside herself. She said, that man is a beast. It's the same idea the Republicans have, many Republicans have about Donald Trump. He may have a lot of money. He doesn't have class. He doesn't have brought up, see. He's crude. And he's an embarrassment at that level. And he's all the more embarrassing because with all the clout that they used to have as, you know, the well-starched Republican set, here comes a guy who has no respect for any of that at all, has just barged right through all of the precepts of order and dignity and whatever else they held dear, and is now in charge and is running and proposes to run both the party and the country like a corporate acquisition. That's his mentality. He's very crude. And that is the future of the Democratic, of the Republican Party. On the Democratic side, we have somebody who has spent a lot of time in public life, much of it under the warm glow of investigation, and her husband. And now they're raising their daughter to pick up from where they are going to leave off. And with all that she has going, she still is struggling to put a great deal of distance between herself and Donald Trump. Now, this is the duopoly behaving like a duopoly, except in this election cycle, there are elements that have entered the discussion that just weren't there before. And so it is, from a historical point of view, a very noteworthy election year. For those of us who have real distrust for the duopoly, but who saw the inkling of an encouraging sign, but we've seen this before, we talked about it. The question is then, what do we do about the dilemma that we have? We don't like and we can't abide, we can't support what is there. We've been betrayed. There may be some miracle, and by some miracle, maybe people might have gone to Sanders and said, hey, you better do something about the position you put yourself and us in. We have third-party efforts that have good ideas, but no organization to speak of, so that even if they were supported, there is no mechanism to quantify and maximize the power of the vote. They have not, over these many years, and I say this not as a, you know, blaming, this is just the fact. Much of the difficulty with the Green Party and other small parties is that they lacking the resources that the duopoly has, for example. It's a spit and chewing gum budget. And there's, I mean, we have to be realistic. There's only so much that they can do. However, I still say they have been around long enough to have accomplished a heck of a lot more than they have at this point. And point number one is that they're not on enough ballots across these United States to pose any kind of political threat, so that people will get perhaps an emotional sense of satisfaction in casting a vote or casting their lot with such a party. But the point is, at some point, we have to get to the idea that you're in this thing of electoral politics to score points, to win something. So, given this scenario, what do we do? Which is the best direction to take? We have a very small window of time because the general election is in November. What are some of the practical things that you can do to maximize the leverage that we might have had and lost or still do have, but we don't know it? What might we do to maximize that political leverage? How do we change our political awareness and clarity and orientation, and therefore our political action? This is the basic story that we've been tackling in all these different ways, but that's essentially the point. We are at a juncture where we have to make up our minds. We have to do something. What is the most constructive thing to do at this point? And I want us to depart from the broad view. We get it. There is a broad view. I'm looking for specificity today. What specifically should this large community, we get a sense that people are lost. 13 million people is a lot of people to be lost. And we have not included those people who are so turned off that they don't want to have anything to do with this political process. How do you engage them? How do you bring people, how do you galvanize this effort so that it isn't a continuation of the same old story, that it's the duopoly? And we all get it. We all accept it, it seems. It's the duopoly that's running things. Everybody else, you know, you're just a bystander in the political process. How do we start winning? And how do we take the power that we have? Where does it lie? How do we begin to fashion it into something malleable, something forceful enough that does the job? And there's only one job in politics, if you're in it. There's only one job. The job is to win turf and keep your turf, protect your turf. Win your ground, protect the ground you've won. You see? Now, some people would say, well, you know, you're talking just like them. Yes, I am. Because I think we have to grow up and stop having illusions about politics. You're either in it or you're not. But if you're going to be in it, let's not play tiddlywinks around here. You're either in it because you have in mind to win something. We've gone through enough cycles of talking, but we're not winning. And we're not winning because it seems as if, you know, it's really not the desired outcome. You want people to feel good. You want people to be educated and all. These are not the goals of politics. It has only one goal. The goal is to win. It's not about making you feel good. It's not about morals. It's about winning. And organizing in such a way that you do win. Now, am I off the track here? You're going to tell me at 888-874-4888. Let's hear what you're thinking. I'm saying it's time. This is a period in which we have received or should have received absolute and certain clarity about what we are in for, what we're existing in, what the system is about, and therefore we should make up our mind, do we want to be in it or not? Do we want to win something or not? Do we want to be political in that sense or not? But we can't do this kind of stuff of wavering and thinking that it's good enough to have high-minded ideals and to, you know, see the big picture and be magnanimous and talk about all of us being together and having a shared agenda. All that is great. But after all of that kind of talk, what are you doing to win? It's as simple as that. You either want to do it or you don't. But I think we shouldn't, after this kind of a cycle that we've been through, I think we should dispense with all these illusions about politics and be realistic about what our concerns are and how far we are committed to going. When I talk to people about politics, they seem to be real clear about what needs to be done. Great. As Mike Tyson says, everybody knows about fighting until you get hit in the jaw. And then reality strikes, and then you go, well, gee, I didn't see that coming. Well, look, you got to get hip to what politics is. That doesn't mean you have to subscribe to the duopoly's definition of it or the way they handle it. But we certainly have been down this road many times, enough times to have acquired certain wisdoms, even though they might have been acquired the hard way. But we're not growing up. We're not applying what we've learned. And we seem to be content just feeling superior, that we have a superior understanding of the problem. That's not enough, is it? From California, Steve, what are your thoughts? Steve, you're on the air.
Yeah, you know, I think in America, it's about marketing. And a third party, perhaps, such as the Green Party, might do well to hire a really great PR firm or somebody who can create an idea and an emotion that says, well, maybe it's cool to be different from the mainstream, or maybe it's great to be an individual or an original person. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, my thing is, there's enough work already done by the Green Party to give it a sense of orientation about where its support potentially lies and where it actually lies. They have numbers. They know where their strong areas are, and they know the areas that have potential in terms of appeal. But they're not working hard enough at it.
Well, you know, there are some public radio stations around here, like KPFK, who are constantly trying to raise funds on their drives. And it gets kind of old because it's so constant. And it seems like the money thing could be handled, the generation of funds could be handled in a creative way somehow. That doesn't involve that kind of repetition and that boring repetition. And maybe the Green Party could find a way to raise funds so they could get on the map more, because they seem to be so far off the map of the general awareness.
It seems to me the Green Party has to make a decision as to whether it wishes to be a national party or not. If it can't sustain a national profile, it ought to just take a breather and figure out how it can improve. But the problem I have is that we go through the same cycle year after year. If you know you're not going to be widely available to voters and potential voters, then why don't you just retool and say, rather than go for a national office, we're going to concentrate on four congressional districts. We're going to go after these because we have enough votes in these areas to sustain a really good contest against the duopoly in these areas, and go after them and win them, but win them. You don't have to have a national party all the time to run for national office. practically, I mean, let's deal with reality here. Can the Green Party actually win the presidency, given all the pragmatic hurdles that it has to encounter and deal with, the issue of funding and so forth? So why isn't it retooling?
Yeah, I think that's some good points that you've made about more local contests but that's more the long game. That's not 2016, and I think that a lot of people are really concerned about what's happening in this presidential election.
But people are concerned because their concern is being shaped by media propaganda. It's just the same thing I talked about. People are concerned about the Supreme Court. When you take a sober analysis of the Supreme Court, you know that that's not really where you need to worry about. Where you need to concentrate on is the lower courts. That's where the slaughter is.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Okay. So that's what's producing your 2.2 million people in prisons and jails. That's where you have your heavy populations, either in prison, jail, or under some kind of law enforcement supervision. So if you understand these things, yeah, I'm worried about the Supreme Court. That's their story. That's fine. You go ahead and deal with your story. I deal with a story that I see where the statistics are. I see where the problem is. So the Green Party, to me, needs to do something pragmatic and reshape itself.
In terms of 2016, who will you vote for if it really comes down to it, where the main candidates are Trump and Clinton?
I'm not voting. Made it clear. I have not voted in almost 20 years.
Okay.
And I have not, and I came to that decision, oddly enough, in the voting booth.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually there when I felt so insulted as a voter to vote yes, no on a multi-million dollar project that was described in exactly two or three lines. It's an insult to the voter. And I say, I'm not going to be insulted this way. And I won't vote until there is, to my mind, a compelling reason to do so. There has been no compelling reason for me to vote, including the election of Barack Obama twice. I did not vote.
Mm-hmm.
He showed himself to me, and I believed him. He showed himself to be a tool of the Democratic Party, who more than likely will not have a mind. He's a creation.
Well, I kind of agree with everything you're saying. It might be interesting sometime let's say someone like Trump or the most evil person gets elected. Well, that's even debatable. But whoever gets elected and possibly hastens a collapse of our entire system, maybe that's a positive thing.
I don't think so. Nobody wants to anticipate, such catastrophe. To anticipate catastrophe is not a help. What we need to do is to become more realistic about where we are, what our options are. But we are playing the game in predictable fashion. From now until 2020, the Green Party will lose. Every race, every presidential race from now to 2020, it makes no difference.
But maybe the crisis would hasten more of a active activism.
But is that a good position from which to organize? No. There is a lot that's going for the Green Party. There's a lot that's going for many smaller parties. But they are still playing the game according to the other guy's rules. You don't have a budget to sustain a national advertising campaign. Why pretend and act like you do?
Mm-hmm.
Your strength is in the other direction. Your strength is in going real small. They're going real big. You go real small. And you bolster, you anchor yourselves in the community.
Well,
you identify small offices and you go after them.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't need to repeat the process that the big guys are using. They can do what they have to do or want to do because they have the money. They have the organization. They have the media in their pockets. But if you choose to pattern yourself after them, you're going to end up with the same result every time. And it's designed to lock you out. It's designed to make you fail. So why play along? It should be clear to small parties that have great progress, great potential by now, it should be clear to them that they got to stop and rethink this whole proposition about winning. What is winning? You're not going to win the presidential election. You're not. You can lead up to that, and you have a good potential for winning, but you have to redefine winning. How is Jill Stein possibly going to win a presidential race? I mean, let's be real. And she has brilliant ideas. Great ideas. Yeah. Ralph Nader had great ideas. He was one of the worst candidates out there. He had no personality whatsoever.
Well, yeah, but he would have made the best president we ever had. That's the problem.
This is my point. If you can't play by their rules, because their rules require you to be very personable. That's why Trump is winning. And Hillary is not. Trump is a very engaging personality. Claptrap is what has brought him to national and international attention. Silly stuff.
So do you think that's impossible for Stein to achieve?
I'm saying understand what you're about and retool to win, but redefine winning.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot run by their rules and win. It's not designed for you to do that way. So what is your alternative plan? What is your backup plan? You can't run it the way you're running now and achieve anything except frustration.
Wasn't the American Revolution kind of a guerrilla warfare that really used a passionate minority to break away from England? So maybe a guerrilla marketing or guerrilla warfare on some level has to occur.
We have had very encouraging signs and signals from these so-called third-party efforts, going back to Jesse Jackson, Shirley Chisholm, going back to Shirley Chisholm even. Even with a spit-and-chewing gum budget, a very small organization, to call it an organization is to actually exaggerate things. It's a ragtag crew. But they made incredible inroads. I don't see that as a defeat at all. They did do remarkably well. What they didn't do was to hold to designing an alternative system. Instead, they fed into, they thought that they had to do the same thing that the big guys are doing.
Mm-hmm.
When you are looking at an extremely narrow market, and it's there, and it wants you. It wants to hear from you. It wants to support you.
Mm-hmm.
So put something together. I remember in Brooklyn, I used to write about banking quite a lot, and I wrote about community banking mostly. And there is this unofficial kind of banking. People thought it was a primitive idea where people would operate what in the Caribbean is called a susu or box. And that is a group of people get together And each, every so often, they determine that, let's say once a month, each person puts in a certain amount of money, and one person draws the entire pot.
Right.
Okay? That's been going on ever since I was a kid. This was considered very primitive. But guess what? There are SUSU accounts being established by these well-respected banks. Now, in Brooklyn, SUSU accounts.
Oh.
They got hip to the idea. We're missing out. And whereas these so-called primitive systems existed and served the need exactly in compatibility with the culture, it was a practice self-controlled, self-directed, and very efficient. That was a good thing. So the idea was to proliferate the SUSU, not hand it to the banks. They got hit to the idea. If you have pull, the Green Party has pull with people who are environmentally conscious. You have people who have pull with Bernie Sanders because he favors certain positions on trade and so forth. And he's talking about a minimum wage and things that progressives are. Then you build on that. There's no shame in being small. If you're winning, when you have 13 million plus votes, and you're the second biggest winner in the Democratic Party and a first-time candidate for president, that is nothing to sneeze about. But if you're now going to take the route that has been dictated for you, you're destroying your own revolution. And you're wasting people's time. So that's the come to reality meeting that we need to have. Thanks so much, Steve. I enjoyed talking with you today.
You too.
We go to New York next. Juan, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello. Hello, Yatrice. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
Good. I'm in my 60s. I'm Spanish-speaking from the Caribbean, and I've been living in Virginia for some time, since the 90s. And recently I met a brother of African descent. He is in his 60s. He suffered a stroke. He is homeless, yet he has a house. Now, his house is not in good condition. Now, there isn't an agency, a coalition headed by us, black, brown, and Native American people, to which a person like him and the women and children who find themselves in these horrific, in their traumatizing condition of homelessness can resort to be helped. And it is heartbreaking for me to watch this brother going around with little bags and stuff. He got mugged a few times, but you're young. So the thing is that I don't want to take too much time of your problem, but there is an urgent need in our community to establish construction companies specifically designed to fulfill the needs that our precious people have. And that doesn't exist now. Yeah, there are companies, but they are headed by others from outside of our communities. We need to establish those so that our children can see us doing God's will. Recently, a few years ago, a young sister from D.C., she was from somewhere between 13 and 17 years old. She was very brave and went up to the mic in a group in a meeting of adults, and she asked two very important questions. She asked, where are the adults? Why do the adults allow outsiders to come and take over all the local businesses? And then she asked, where are the adults? Why do they allow outsiders to drive us out of our traditional neighborhoods? Now, the children are saying that, and we are not fulfilling our roles. They don't see us in the community doing that. And there is an urgent need for the children to see us fulfilling the roles that God and others, our ancestors, provided for us, designed for us. And I would love for you to get me in contact with Nellie Bailey or Glenn Ford or if you allow me to meet with you in person. I'm in my 60s. I don't have a criminal record and everything. My brother's a very important musician here in the city, and the artistic community has immense fundraising and sensitizing and unifying a possibility. So we have to take advantage of any possibility available to us so that we can put together a coalition to begin to
heal our community. I'm listening to what you're saying. I'm listening to what you're saying, and I don't mean to sound harsh of it at all. And I believe me, I don't. What is important, because a lot of we get confused between what looks like movement and what actually is movement. Movement is very unattractive. It's very hard. It's very unsexy. That's a kind of work. When you are in service to your community, you don't have, I know, I get news releases every day from these organizations about the next awards dinner that they're having.
Right.
Yeah, I'm saying, no, that's not how it gets done.
Right.
You know, show me your hands. Show me where you have invested your sweat equity. You know, that's where the work is to be done. And not enough people are doing that. The other thing is, and I agree with you, people do need, there is a great deal of blaming, though, and people leveling, pointing the fingers, well, you're not doing this. Okay, great, fine, wonderful. What did you get out of laying blame? You show me your record of involvement, and beyond involvement, show me your record of achievement and success. Now we start talking.
Right.
I once asked a person who came to me talking about a nonprofit program that they wanted to start up. And my first question was, when do you intend to go out of business? And you looked at me like, what the heck are you talking about? Because from the very beginning, the concept was that this program was to exist in perpetuity.
Right.
And I said, no, that's not it. If you're interested in helping people, you start from the point of view of when you will have achieved your objective, and you count backwards. If it's going to take you 5 years, you have a 5-year plan. Where is your plan?
Right.
Okay. Now, when I start talking to people like this, they get a little rankled, and they go, well, we're just trying to do something. Well, you have to try and do it a different way. You start from the end, and you work backwards. You start with your end objective. What are you hoping to achieve? How much time is it going to take you to achieve that? And then you count backwards. If it's going to take you 5 years, so every year is 5 years minus one, 5 years minus two, 5 years minus three. But by 5 years, you should have achieved your objective. If you haven't, pack it up and go away and stop annoying people. We got to be serious. So, yes, people are very willing to point fingers about what needs to be done, what hasn't been done, who needs to get to do it, and all that. At some point, the rubber meets the road. Show me what you can do. Show me what you have done. And show me your plan for success. But it's great to know that you are, I know I've talked with you about this program before. It's a fantastic and splendid idea, and it is also very necessary. The thing, though, is to develop a model that has in mind as an objective the achievement of self-sustenance, self-maintenance. Not always the idea that it's supposed to go on until the end of time. But talk to me some more, Juan, and write me at leadstories@gmail.com.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. From Chicago, Henry. You all riled up this week, Henry.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. but you're bringing fire. Your callers are bringing the fire about, you know, ideas about politics. But I wanted to talk about something that you had touched upon about,
you know, the reality of politics. Because one thing, and you probably have experienced it just like everybody else, that one reality people don't want to confront is politics has to involve money. It just doesn't involve numbers. You have to have money to run a successful campaign. And the thing about it is that people think that, you know, because you have the numbers, you know, that you're going to automatically win. No, you have to have money and some control of the money in order to, you know, win a successful campaign. And when you were talking about the reason why third parties don't succeed, and I'm absolutely 100% with you on this, is that they don't look at, you know, the smaller battles that they can win. Last year, we had an election here in Chicago, and Homie the Clown could have ran against Rahm Emanuel and won, because there were just so many reasons Chicagoans just wanted to vote this guy out. And it would have done a third party some good to just come in and have some candidate here to run against Rahm Emanuel. And you would have had a candidate in a major city in Chicago, and that would have got them on the map. And I think we had talked about this before about, you know, why doesn't the Green Party take advantage of this? Now, I'm going to tell you this. Rahm Emanuel's approval rating is going down and down by the minute. And I'm like, okay, somebody needs to come here. If a third party is serious about growing their, you know, growing their portfolio, you know, they need to come in here and try to win this mayoral election along with some of the aldermanic races here in Chicago. And I'm telling you, Trace, and I'm going to tell you from firsthand experience, you have over half the aldermen that are black here, and I'm telling you, all of them are sellouts to Rahm Emanuel. The only progressive aldermen that you have here are Latino. That's the only ones you have here. So in these communities, somebody needs to come up in here, you know, or we need to organize, and that's the thing that I'm trying to do with some other like-minded Chicagoans here, is to try to come in here and try to run some of these aldermen out of the city because of the fact that they're just decimating, you know, some of these areas with Rahm Emanuel's policy. So Chicago is a good breeding ground for any third party who wants to grow, you know, their portfolio in the eyes of the nation. Because if they see a third party candidate, you know, become a mayor of a particular city, you know, especially the third largest city in the country, you know, that will definitely bring some more people around the country. So, you know, they can't just be thinking on a level of, well, we're just going to run for the president. No, that doesn't work. Look at what happened with the Tea Party move. You know, the Tea Party didn't, you know, have a candidate, you know, for president. You know, they ran congressional seats and actually won some of them. So it was like they knew what their limits were, but they were going to keep growing it, you know, by just running for, you know, congressional seats so they can, you know, probably, you know, hopefully take the House, you know?
Well, they could have had a very big part to boast about in this last mayoral election. Chuy Garcia, I don't care what anybody says, would have been a far better choice than Rahm Emanuel, but they walked away from him. Chuy Garcia should have had a very solid coalition behind him, except that people could not overcome these barriers, these historic barriers, and the demands of the party and the wrath of the party if they were seen as, you know, straying off the farm.
Yes,
but that was an excellent opportunity to capture a major seat in a major city that would have had incredible ramifications just to change the mayor of the city of Chicago and put in Chuy Garcia. I'm not suggesting that he was an ideal candidate. Nobody is an ideal candidate. But when you I mean, if you're playing politics in a pragmatic way, he was not. He certainly was not as bad as Rahm Emanuel, and he did have quite a bit of community support.
Yes, he did. And but you know, the thing too is that as you know, as I think about it, study it, and talk to people, you know, Chuy was also still entrenched in the Democratic machine here in Chicago, which maybe hurt him. And I agree with you. Chuy was a much better candidate than Rahm Emanuel. You know, I'm just saying that a third party, you know, even in a heavily Democratic city that is starting to get tired of the Democratic process, you know, the Democratic Party here in Chicago is just looking for somebody to come in and challenge these people.
But this is what I mean by redefining winning. You don't have to win as a third party, but you can win as a third party supporting a candidate and playing a critical role in the success of that candidate at the polls. And then you build from there. You find strategic alliances that you can forge that bring your party into focus as, wow, when these people get involved, they pick and choose their stuff, but when they get involved, that person wins. That is a form of encouragement to people who are enmeshed in the party process, in the Democratic, they're entrenched in the Democratic Party process. They can feel safer moving away from the Democratic Party if they can count on help from people who, like the Green Party and other parties, that could come to the situation saying, well, we can't win this spot for ourselves, but we can help you win. And that's mm-hmm. also a way of winning.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah.
that's why unions are so important to the political process. They're not running a union candidate, but everybody knows the difference between victory and defeat in many cases is because the unions would be supporting this candidate or that candidate. So mm-hmm. they gain power by assisting in the success, the political success of a particular candidate. And that is winning.
Yeah. And going back to the money thing, because, you know, you were talking about Bernie Sanders and 13 million votes. Well, what would happen, you know, what this would change the game economically. If let's just say 10 million of those people just contributed $5, you have $50 million to work with there.
Hello.
I mean, that's a lot.
That's a
lot of money to work with. Yes, that's a lot of money to work with. And then at that point, the next election cycle, Bernie could have a serious chance of winning.
Look, Bernie Sanders right now is uniquely qualified, uniquely able to destroy Hillary Clinton right off the bat. He can destroy her. No problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
He's got 13 million votes. However, do you know what would happen to Hillary Clinton if Bernie Sanders, on come Monday, when he's having this meeting with his delegates and is expected to make another fawning speech in favor of Hillary, if Bernie Sanders were to say, look, I'm taking my delegates, I'm taking my people, and I am continuing. We wish you the best of luck, Hillary. But see ya. We're gone. We mm-hmm. are about building this thing. That's how serious we are. We do not identify with this Democratic Party anymore. It has ceased to be relevant to the lives of all these people who historically have invested in it. And it's time for a new thing to happen.
And it's unfortunate because that's what Ted Cruz is doing in the Republican Party.
Hello! He just said last night, I'm in your house, I'm staring you in your face, and guess what? I ain't endorsing you.
That's what Bernie should have been doing.
That's exactly what we should. Well, we'll see. We shall see if there's a surprise in store from Brother Bernie next week and see whether this dedication to the revolution transcends party politics, and or whether he has basically been bought and paid for. But in any event, it is up to those 13 million people to compel him, to behave differently. Because, you see, it isn't Bernie's revolution. It's theirs. He was a vehicle, and they should grow up to understand that and flex their own muscles. They don't have to wait for Bernie to do something. They got the power. So they should be organizing right now outside of the Democratic Party to influence the outcome of the presidential election and to punish the Democratic Party as well. Thanks so much for calling in. Always a pleasure talking with you, Henry.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of our program today. I enjoyed talking, and we have to talk because the times are very serious, and we have to talk things through. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. You can reach me at Lead Stories, L-E-I-D, stories, plural, at gmail.com. Always a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. I so cherish and value it. See you tomorrow. That I can do.